For week 7 of our ongoing series, Wisdom of Solomon. Really good to be back. My family and I, Jen and I, have enjoyed the last couple of weeks of vacation. We even took our kids with us on vacation, which was actually really, really wonderful. And great to be back with you, but missing you, and just couldn't be happier to be back in this place with you today. And these words have been ringing in my head all morning. There's no shadow you won't light up, mountain you won't climb up coming after me. There's no wall you won't kick down, lie you won't tear down coming after me. What a great and wonderful and powerful promise we receive from the goodness of God. And I want to go from there to segue right into what we're talking about today and to say, we're going to talk about a bit of a tough subject today, but I want to anchor all of that. I want to root everything in what we're going to study in Scripture today in this reality and this truth that there is no part of God's character that looks down on you or me with a waving finger from heaven saying you've been a really bad boy or a really bad girl. That's something we kind of put on ourselves for those who lean deeply into the supernatural realm. Certainly we have an enemy of our soul, the devil, who speaks those sorts of lies over us. But we serve a God who loves us deeply and longs to simply invite us in to a greater depth of freedom and joy as we live. And that's only found on the process and in the development of our own lives becoming more Christ-like. So we just enjoy that together. My thanks to Pastor Dan, who over the last couple of weeks has just done, as always, a stellar job leading us in the Word. So thank you, Pastor Dan. I get told all the time that I need to remind us as a community, and so I'm trying to do it more often, just by way of reminder that every single one of our staff members work a full-time job in the marketplace and then serve on staff at Disciples. Not that there are many pastors that live this sort of life, but none of us are like hanging out in coffee shops 8 hours a day, like, you know, with our feet up reading books on theology, chilling and taking naps. Like, we're like working real jobs like you are and then give our time to the church. So when Dan steps in after running a realty business all week and finds 10, 12, 15 hours to study the Word and share a message with us, we ought thank him for that and feel that deeply. So thanks, Dan. You did an amazing job. So in these weeks of vacation, I've been catching up and watching the sermons, and I tend to find the YouTube app to be like my easiest way to catch up on the sermons. Maybe use the website or the podcast or whatever else. We try and push it out there in a lot of different ways, but I've just been reflecting on what a great and powerful staff we have to share the Word, and grateful for you, Dan, grateful for Pastor Doug and when he speaks as well. But I've also been reflecting on something else as we think about the wisdom of Solomon. And I don't know if you've been feeling any of this with me, but as I've been watching that in the back of my mind, in the back of my heart, I'm reminded that Solomon, as it's told in Kings and also in Chronicles, Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived or ever will live. Very clearly states. And yet, if you know any of the story about Solomon, you know he did some really foolish stuff. I mean, any man who would get it in his head that 700 wives is a good decision is like not living really wisely, right? That is a ton of purses. I just want to throw that out there. I don't mean to minimize you women down to purses, but he's just a broken guy. Messed up, fallible, who made mistakes all over the place. And I'm reminded as I read through that, not unlike myself, I'm sure that you can feel this too, not unlike yourself, there is a sense in which we connect with Solomon, that there's something more than simply wisdom that will lead us to Christ's likeness. You have to actually walk through the wisdom. You have to actually dig into this stuff. The Apostle Paul felt the same way in Romans 7. He writes, I don't really understand myself, for I want to do what is right, but I don't do it. Instead, I do what I hate. He goes on to say, the very things I know I should do, I don't do. And the very things I know I shouldn't do, I find myself doing over and over and over. And so as we enter week 7 of the Wisdom of Solomon, today we dig in continually. But I want to say what probably could go left unsaid, but I want to be sure that we understand this, that simply wisdom is not the end goal of our life with God. Wisdom is a means to the end. And the end for you and I is Christ-likeness. And there is no other way for you and I to become Christ-like if we reject wisdom. It just won't happen. So wisdom is not the end. It's Christ-likeness is what we're going after. It's obedience to the ways of Jesus. It's holiness in his presence. See, there's no moral victory for you and I if we scream at our kids, but we know in our head that's not good for them. Does that make sense? Like, there's no asterisk next to us in our behavior when we understand the insight that we ought to be generous and serve, and our life ought to pour over with goodness, with humility. And then yet we think we get an asterisk if we know that stuff, but we continue to be greedy and selfish and angry and proud. There's a dot that's got to be connected for you and I to experience the full joy of what it is to actually follow Jesus. And that's to connect that dot between wisdom and obedience. This idea is no more visible, I think, in any area of my life, likely your life as well, than in the area of what we say, the words that we use, our talk, the conversations we allow ourselves to have. Now, I know you're thinking, don't go there, don't say that. You've had these moments. I know this. Like, if you're anything like me, Jen and I have had times when we've been driving in the car headed to dinner to meet with friends. And we know that these friends, God bless them, right? Just like grandma, you say God bless them and then you can insult them. God bless them. We know at some point tonight, they're going to want to turn the conversation to this negativity or that harsh word. And so we even strategize in the car, like, how do we do this? So when they go there, we're going to juke and jive there. We're going to go there. And then, you know, just like all of us, you get an hour into the conversation and realize, oh, we went there. There is no place, I'm convinced, where wisdom seems to find itself disconnected from our life of Christ-likeness more than in the area of our talk, in our speech. And the verses just flow on this. There are so many of them. Look at Proverbs 10:19. It'll be on screen. Too much talk leads to sin. Be sensible and keep your mouth shut. You ever whispered that to yourself? I don't do it enough. Keep your mouth shut, Stu. Keep your mouth shut. In another place in Scripture, the Apostle James writes these words in chapter 3. Indeed, we all make many mistakes, for if we could control our tongues, we would be perfect and could also control ourselves in every other way. James goes on in that very chapter to paint a pretty bleak picture, or maybe simply an accurate reflection of the trouble our world finds itself in every day because of the things you and I say. For those who are still meeting in their life groups this week, I just encourage you to dive in deep into James 3. He goes on for some time, and there's some rich fruit there for us throughout the chapter of James 3 on what we say. But for today, we're going to be in Proverbs chapter 17. So if you've got a Bible, go there now. If you didn't bring a Bible with you, there should be a printed copy of the scriptures in a seat pocket there nearby. Otherwise, a digital version is a great way to go. There's an app in your app store called YouVersion. I think you'll love that. I'm going to use the New Living Translation if you want to follow along the same version. Otherwise, of course, as always, use whatever one you like. And just find yourself in Proverbs 17. As you turn there, let me just say a couple welcomes. Welcome to those of you across the hall in our living room joining us. Welcome to our students who I see out the corner of the window and in the front row beginning to stream in from summer camp. I smell you even now. So I'm just kidding. We don't really smell you. But we're glad to have our students back from summer camp, and good to have them filing back into the building. Those of you joining us online, we love you. Thanks for being part of the journey of faith. Let's go to Proverbs 17. But before we dive in, would you pray with me? Father, Son, and Spirit, these moments are absolutely a waste of time without you at the helm of our lives. So God, we place you as best we know how in the leadership of these moments. Speak to us in the words of King David. Teach us your ways so we might walk in your truth. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. So there he was in the conversation, not just the conversation of his life, but the conversation for his life. It was kind of a classic he said, she said sort of scenario. You've been caught in this, I know, 100 times. Somebody said something or twisted your words just enough to make them sound way different than you intended for them to mean, or twisted your meaning to mean something altogether different. He was there now, and he stood on trial, and uniquely he stood at a very, very public trial as a defendant. The first judge who had been hearing his case threw it out because the public unrest and the shouting and screaming from the gallery was so much that the prior judge said, I'm not even going to hear the case. I'm sending it to another judge who's better in a better jurisdiction to hear the case. And the new judge stuck with this case is in the public square and hearing the shouts and the raging screams of everyone in the city square, calling for this man's death. They wanted the death penalty. And they felt that they had the juice behind it to make it happen. So there he stands on trial. The mob yelling, shouting for the death penalty. And they're claiming that he has encouraged people to go against the government's instructions and to steal money from the government. They go on to say he causes riots everywhere he goes. In every city and town he finds himself, a riot breaks out. And in front of the very people who are calling for his execution, the judge looks to him and says, are you really going to say that you want to be these people's king? And up to this point, he's been totally silent. And the only words he utters in the entire trial are these words after the judge says, are these really the people who you say that you are the king of? And he looks to the judge and simply says, your words, not mine. So you say. The accusations continue and the insults are hurled and the crowd continues to grow in their rage. And the judge finally says, listen, I can't find him guilty of the crimes you've claimed. And even if he was guilty of those crimes, it doesn't deserve death. So here is what we're going to do. We're going to punish him lightly. We'll give him a little flogging and send him on his way. And the cries rage even louder. And all the while, the defendant, in the conversation for his life, says nothing. Doesn't set him straight on how his words have been twisted. Doesn't argue to win the battle. Doesn't come up with some wise conundrum to freak them out. He sat there and he remained silent. And just as the judge turns to the crowd to tell them once again he doesn't deserve death, they scream these words that whether you've been around church forever or never been in at all, you know. And they yell, crucify it. Crucify it. And he was silent. And as history would prove, once again, the loudest voice usually wins the argument. Or at least the loudest voice is the only voice still screaming when the other person has walked out of the room and slammed the door as hard as they can to show that they don't want any part of it anymore. So what in the world made him quiet? What in the world made this Jesus of Nazareth remain utterly silent in the conversation for his life? If you were to go across the hall to the kids' room and ask a bunch of fourth graders or four-year-olds and say, why was Jesus quiet? They would say something like, well, because he's Jesus, right? Or, you know, a little more advanced theological background. And maybe you would say, well, because, you know, he was fully God and he was fully man and he knew what was coming. And while these accusations weren't true, it was playing right in to the perfect plan of the Lord that Christ would bring salvation through his death. And all of that is certainly true. But really? Like, Jesus had never been short of words prior. Like, he kind of like preached really long sermons. He talked a lot. And now all of a sudden he's silent. And the painful yet beautiful reality that only true wisdom can uncover is this truth that God's will moves forward even in the midst of false accusation and lies and betrayal. And every time you and I are faced with the reality of a false accusation or a lie or our words got twisted or something as simple as this idiot doesn't believe something that I believe to be true, I must set them straight. And of course, the best place to do that is Facebook, right? We go out to the Huffington Post and we find some article to support our argument. We repost it and we go, oh, I showed them. And then we stand by our phone and we wait for the notification to refresh so we can muscle up again and argue some more. Or we fire off that nasty text and we look and we wait for their little text thing to pop back. Oh, they're trying. Oh, I'm going to get them now. Or maybe more sadly, we stand on the other side of the threshold of the door with someone we once loved deeply, and we hurl insults at them, and we argue, and we fight. And I'm convinced that all of this boils down to a few things, and one of them is simple as this, that when I feel that I must argue the case, I am simply proving that I don't believe God can handle the universe without me. Like, I can't believe this person would vote that way. I must make them understand. I can't believe that this person would be for that freedom being taken or that freedom being given. I must argue them onto my side of things. And meanwhile, the greater narrative of what you and I communicate when we do that is, I don't actually think God can handle the universe without my help. Maybe you're familiar with one of Aesop's famous fables. Story of a turtle who was really, really jealous of the ducks. You know the turtle and the ducks? The turtle was so jealous, the ducks would come around the pond every day and they would talk about how beautiful the outside world was outside of this pond. And they would talk about the beauty of the meadow and how wonderful it was to fly over the trees and to see the breeze floating leaves. And they often would talk about flying over to the next pond, over the next hill, and how beautiful and wonderful the world was. And meanwhile, the turtle was always so jealous and had such difficulty not being able to see the world. So finally, one day, the ducks get together and they talk to each other. Quack, 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 quack. Because that's how ducks talk. And they say to one another, we got to help out our buddy Turtle here. And so they grabbed a stick and they said, okay, Turtle, here's what's going to happen. We're going to each hold one end of the stick in each of our mouths. And you grab onto the center of the stick. And we're going to fly you high above the pond and give you a view of the world. And the turtle was ecstatic. And they said, but one thing, don't open your mouth or bad things will happen. And they begin to fly over the pond, and just as they had been talking about prior, everything was beautiful. He got to see a meadow that he had never seen before and flowers blooming that he didn't know existed. He got to look down on the frogs, which, you know, who doesn't want to look down on a frog, right? And he flew over the mountains and he saw beautiful things there as well. Just then, a crow flies up nearby them, looks to the two ducks, says to the two ducks, surely this is the king of all the turtles. And before the crow could even finish, the turtle speaks up, why, certainly I am. And before he can get the rest of the sentence out of his mouth, He lost his grip on the stick and fell to his death. And I get it. It's a simple and a silly and a juvenile little fable. But the truth of the matter is, all of grandma's trite little sayings that fit on your little Pinterest board when it comes to keeping your mouth shut actually are true. Like the old, remember the old one of you have two ears and one mouth, maybe use the ears more than the mouth. You ever hear the one, you can't unring that bell. You can't unsay that. I mean, you know a thousand of them. The turtle falls to his death because he just had to speak up. But God's will moves forward. Even in the midst of false accusation and lies and betrayal. I mean, remember Jesus' words earlier in his ministry in Matthew 10. He says, for John didn't spend his time eating and drinking, and you say he's possessed by a demon. And the Son of Man, on the other hand, feasts and drinks, and you say he's a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and other sinners. But wisdom is shown to be right by its results. This is the key of connecting wisdom and insight to actual ways of living for you and I. Look with me at Proverbs 17. You knew we would get there eventually. Here we are. Proverbs 17, beginning in verse 1. Better a dry crust eaten in peace than a house filled with feasting and conflict. Now, I don't know about you, but I cannot put my finger on a single conflict in my house ever that didn't have something to do with something somebody said or something somebody didn't say that they should have said. You ever notice that? Like, conflict always arises out of what we've said, what we wish we could take back. Verse 2, a wise servant will rule over the master's disgraceful son and will share the inheritance of the master's children. Verse 3, fire tests the purity of silver and gold, but the Lord tests the heart. Wrongdoers eagerly listen to gossip. Liars pay close attention to slander. Those who mock the poor insult their maker, and those who rejoice in the misfortune of others will be punished. Grandchildren are the crowning glory of the aged. Parents are the pride of their children. Verse 7, eloquent words are not fitting for a fool. Even less are lies fitting for a ruler. And then skip ahead with me down to the end of the chapter, verses 27 and 28. These quintessential verses. A truly wise person uses few words. A person with understanding is even-tempered. Even fools are thought wise when they keep silent, for with their mouths shut, they seem intelligent. Said a little different way if you grew up around the Christian tradition that goes something like, open your mouth and be thought a fool, or keep your mouth closed and be thought a fool, open your mouth and remove all doubt. How many times in the recent past for you, in your life, have you said to yourself, I should not talk right now. I should keep my mouth shut right now. And I should just listen. And the simple follow-up, not for shame and not for guilt, but for careful reflection upon that reality, I ask the age-old Dr. Phil question. How's that working out for him? Are we doing it? Are we able to just keep our mouth shut? We'll get on to the positive pieces of that a little bit later. But let me first point out this key, that wisdom is not simply a photo of God's will. It's a roadmap to Christ-likeness. So I think we often view wisdom as like sort of this 1D, one-dimensional, set-in-time, non-changing photograph. I mean, look at wisdom and go, that's wise, right? Like money and savings, wise, right? Not gossiping, wise. By the way, both those things are true. But what I'm finding about wisdom, the longer I walk with Jesus, is it's more of a roadmap to Christ likeness. It's like turn by turn navigation for my life becoming more like Jesus, which, by the way, I have found in my life. I don't know about you, but Christianity gets really old really fast if I'm not submitted to transforming my life. Like Christianity just becomes sort of an idea or like a club I'm in if I'm not actually becoming more like Jesus. So wisdom is not simply a photo of God's will. It's a roadmap to Christ-likeness. And wisdom is whispering into your heart and my heart all the time, talk less. Maybe this should have been a 5-minute sermon, right? Just shut your mouth and we'll take an offering and go. And I don't want to be harsh and I'm not trying to be mean. It's so for me, just like it is for all of us. But the truth is, we talk too much. We argue too much. And we're so concerned about being viewed right and setting everyone straight and saying everything we know. Jen and I were on a date Friday night. We had dropped the kids off at summer camp. And I was on the road last week for work and wasn't home, so we were excited to get some time. And so we went to a really nice restaurant in Auburn that we'd never been to, and they didn't have any seating, so they said, well, you can sit at the bar and you can eat dinner there. And so we thought, well, we'll just get an appetizer and kind of feel it out. I don't know that I want to sit at the bar and eat dinner. So we were sitting up there, and this woman around the corner from us kept telling the bartender that I'm a winemaker, and this wine doesn't taste like X or Y or Z. And Jen and I just started counting how many times this woman kept telling everybody at the bar that she's a winemaker and how important she is and how valuable she is. And meanwhile, the whole bar staff is just dying. They're just dying. And we eventually left and didn't even eat dinner there because we just literally could not handle one more minute of hearing this woman tell everybody at the bar how much she knew. And then I got out of the car and went, oh no, I think that's me. I think I'm that guy sometimes. I think I'm that one who sees God's wisdom as like this pretty little picture on the wall, but doesn't realize that it's actually a roadmap for my life and it's leading me through every step. If I would just shut my mouth long enough to listen to God speak, he would lead me to the next best decision. A truly wise person uses few words. I'm reminded, secondly, that a truly wise person shows restraint when they speak. A truly wise person shows restraint when they speak. That if I'm to step into God's wisdom for my life, and if I'm to walk in the wisdom of God with the end game of becoming more like Jesus, I will regularly use restraint when I speak. I will regularly stop myself and say, I don't need to say that. I don't need to talk right now. I can listen right now. That doesn't need to be spoken. Even fools are thought wise when they keep silent. With their mouths shut, they seem intelligent. King David, Solomon's father, you know, we get this wisdom from Solomon, but his dad was pretty wise as well. And King David writes in Psalm 141, take control of what I say, O Lord, and guard my lips. Don't let me drift toward evil or take part in acts of wickedness. The question that comes up for me certainly is, you know, what's a person to do? Because, I mean, as I've said before, the reality is you and I, we don't live our lives at 30,000 feet. Wouldn't it be beautiful if you could live above your life at times and see every move and how the flight path would work if you go this way, but we just don't. You and I live in the cut and thrust, in the trenches of real life. You have a split second to think about how to respond on a very regular basis, and that's how life works. Hey, what do you think about that, Stu? Instead of, you know, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. Let me give that some thought. Like, what a foreign concept to say, you know, I don't really feel prepared to speak on it. But in the cut and thrust of life and in the craziness of everything and in the middle of an argument or in the middle of a text conversation or in the middle of a discussion with your kid's dad or kid's mom or an ex or a parent or a friend or a neighbor. And everything's just happening so quick. And you walk away from a conversation and probably hope that you were received in the best way known. But let me just tell you, as somebody who talks for a living, everything you say gets painted in the worst possible light and then reset. That's just the way the world works. I mean, I hear some things that I say. Sometimes I scroll Facebook on a Sunday afternoon and see some of the things I allegedly said in a sermon. And I'm like, I never said that. Like, somebody posted on Facebook. I'm like, that's good. But I actually didn't even say that. Like, that was never said, but eh, good for you, you know? But that's pretty rare. Like, usually the things you and I say will get twisted and made worse off than they were meant to be. We live in an emotional world with emotions, where we have strong feelings about politics or about freedoms or about our kids or about business or about music or our favorite sports team or a movie we saw. And we just have to let everybody know what we think of them. And so let me give you just a few little practicals. In the midst of a pretty practical talk that isn't maybe super deep theologically, but so deep in terms of our daily living, let me give you a couple practicals in all of this. Firstly, let's remember what Jesus said in Luke 6. He says, a good person produces good things from the treasury of a good heart. He then conversely says, and an evil person produces evil things from the treasury of an evil heart. What you say flows from what is in your heart. These are the words of Jesus, not Stu. What you say flows from what's in your heart. So when that spouting of anger or whatever or defensiveness comes out, that's actually what you are. That's not like, oh yeah, I just lost my temper and I didn't mean that. No, actually, you totally meant that, and that's actually who you are. That's who I am. Another translation says, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. I think the key practical in this is to just remind ourselves to pour overflowing goodness into your heart. If all that ever gets poured into your heart and my heart is Game of Thrones and Jay-Z and arguments with the ex and nasty text messages gossiping about the boss, what do we expect to come out later? Pour overflowing goodness into your heart. And the beauty of this, of willingly stepping into this life of transformation, is while it's effort, yes, it will require work. Again, remember, God's grace is opposed to earning. It's not opposed to effort. God's grace loves effort. It loves it when you and I commit ourselves to this and work at it. But the beautiful thing about this is the transformation happens really fast. I'm amazed how quickly things transform. You ever hit the gym for like 3 weeks and already notice a change? You're like, it took me 20 years to look this flabby. And in 3 weeks, I already feel better. It's amazing. The same is true of our heart. Like if you've just been pouring in garbage and your heart is overflowing with anger and bitterness and snottiness and negativity, and might I just encourage you, maybe 3 times a day for the next week, take 2 minutes, 3 times a day, and read a psalm. 2 minutes, 3 times a day. No 3-hour Bible study. I mean, that's great. Do a 3-hour Bible study. It's fine. But I'm just saying 2 minutes, 3 times a day, where you open up the scriptures and you just read a psalm to yourself. Maybe read it out loud in the car. And you'll be amazed what happens in just the course of a week if 3 times a day we just land back on this. Pour overflowing goodness into your heart. And in a very related way, look at Philippians 4:8. Paul writes to his friends in Philippi. And now, dear brothers and sisters, one final thing. Fix your thoughts on what is true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about things that are excellent and worthy of praise. And I'm telling you, you watch MSNBC or Fox News, you will not be thinking about things that are excellent and worthy of praise. You just won't. Talk radio, negative, friends. Not positive, not helpful. Positive, encouraging words, K-Love. I mean, if you want to hear the same words over and over and over again, but they're at least positive and encouraging. Fix your thoughts on what is true and honorable and right, pure and lovely and admirable, that are excellent and worthy of praise. And there is, if you had to live with me, I mean, just corner Jen later and, you know, ask. If you had to live with me, there is no end to the amount of things you could say about me that aren't good. And that's not a pass. That's not like, I'm just a jerk, so I just get to keep being a jerk. No, I need to be willing to become transformed in the likeness of Jesus too. But what I'm saying is there's no end for anyone in your life of things you could pick out that are not good about them. What if you focused on what was pure and lovely? What if this week when you go out to lunch with a coworker, instead of talking the whole time about what a jerk your boss is, you intentionally talked about the good things about your boss? What if next time you saw the ex or the parent of your children or somebody who's really tough for you, instead of pointing out all the things they do wrong, you thank them for something that they did well? What is excellent and pure and lovely? Remember who controls your thinking. Listen, you and I, we can't control much in this world, right? We can't control the moron driver in front of us in traffic. We can't control the boss's mood. Can't control a lot of things. But we solely are responsible for the control of our own thinking. No one else controls the way we think and what we fix our thoughts. And I'm not just saying let's become a people who always pump sunshine and only say nice things even when they're not true. No, that's not what I'm saying. But there is a sense in which, especially in our community of faith, disciples, that because our value for authenticity is so high, we kind of use that as a pass to be mean. Like, hey, I'm just going to be real with you here. Ever said that? That's like our generation's version of bless their heart. Remember that when grandma would say, well, bless their heart. That woman couldn't cook a pie for life depended on it. And somehow it was like sweet. It was like, well, grandma said bless her heart first, so, you know. So we just say, well, hey, I'm just being real. But boy, that was the worst fill in the blank I've ever seen. I'm just trying to keep it real. Remember who controls your thinking. And out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. This is just what comes out. And especially for those of us who are like out loud processors, this is especially important. Because you've never had a thought that you didn't say first, right? So it's especially important for out loud processors. Because you just are saying things nonstop. Remember the proverb, shut your mouth. I've been woken up a few times this last week with a troubled heart about a conversation I have to have. And I don't want to have it. And I've been talking to God for a couple of days going, God, surely you don't want me to do that. Because I know the conversation is looming. I'm fairly confident nobody else is going to have it with this dear friend of mine. And I've been pretty sure over the last couple of weeks that it will implode the friendship. That it will not end well. That my friend will respond less than happily. And that bad things will happen. And that it will ripple out from there and it will have impact on my family and our church. And all that. But I've got this nagging sense in my spirit that the Lord said, hey, I want you to step into this. I need for you to have this conversation. And we were singing this morning, the God of miracles, the God who was and is to come, the power of the risen Son. And I was just challenged by the Lord in that moment. Like, you believe that I can heal the human body, but you don't believe that I'm in control of this follower of me who you need to have a hard conversation with. And so you've just resigned yourself, Stu, to the fact that as soon as you mention this, it's going to become this big blow up and it's going to be horrible and terrible. I've told the story that we started this church 8 years ago with six or seven friends in a living room. And I think we theologically believe that God could do anything, but I think I had convinced everybody that while God could do anything, he needs Stu for most of it, right? You ever fallen into that trap? Oh, no, not you. Okay. Just me. And so I'm dreading this conversation, and yet the Lord just spoke so clearly to my heart even just this morning. Like, I want you to step in like I'm actually the God of miracles. Like I'm actually the God who rose from the grave, and I'm inviting you to be part of my redemptive story in your friend's life. And the scriptures are very clear how I'm to go about that and how gently I'm to do that. And the challenge to shut my mouth and to not say more than I need to. But listen, you and I are facing these things every week. I believe that the Spirit of the living God wants to use the things you and I say to speak life and goodness and joy to a watching world. But we are so busy talking about what we hate and what we don't like and what the president did and what the last president didn't do, that we forfeit our right to speak goodness and grace and love. And when we're called to do it, we're just convinced it will go bad. The number of topics that are off the table now over dinner conversation are a lot, right? Like we can't talk about guns. We can't talk about hybrid cars. We can't talk about vaccines. We can't talk about politics. We certainly can't talk about religion, right? Like what do we have left? Handbags and sneakers? Let's be a people who do it, but do it with joy and do it with grace and do it with love and do it with as few words as possible. Would you pray with me? Oh God, I didn't want to preach this message. You know that. And mostly because I'm just so convicted, God, that I talk too much. And that there are ways in which I forfeit your redemptive power through gracious speech. Because I'm quick to say what I think and what I feel. And so if I'm feeling that, God, I bet my friends here feel that too. That there are times when you've called us to make a huge impact on those 8 to 15 people in our lives that you've strategically placed in our path, and we forfeit the right to speak joy to them because we're so busy pointing out everything they did wrong or everything about them we don't like. So God, on this path to wisdom, on this roadmap that you've given us towards freedom and Christ's likeness, Holy Spirit, we're asking that you would give us a special portion of your still small voice to get us to shut up. The life that would be in that. And that God, when it is time to speak up, that we would remember that you are the God who was and is to come. That you have given to us the power of the risen Son. You've entrusted us with your power and your grace. May we speak boldly of goodness, boldly of truth. I don't know where you're at with Jesus today, but I want to just give you a moment, whether you've been walking with him a long time or it's all new, to just listen to his voice of what he might be saying to you in this moment. Where are the areas where you've been speaking up to? For the areas where your words have been hurtful to the very people you love? Who's the person you need to apologize to today and ask forgiveness? Amazing goodness of God's transforming power is that that transformation begins to happen so quickly. And in a couple minutes a day, three times a day, four times a day, when we just intentionally fix our eyes back on what is good and pure and true and honorable and admirable and excellent, we make space, we create space in our life for God to do his miracle working power in us. Would you submit to it with me? Let's stand and worship the Lord. I'll be back to wrap this up.